She says child abuse is an American public health crisis that harms the child, the family, and the country. She is Ann Kahn Donnelly, longtime executive director for the National Committee to Prevent Child Abuse, and she's today's guest on KUAC's Conversations. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I wanted to give us a chance to understand this notion of public health crisis and do so in its parts. When we're talking about child abuse, we're not just talking about the physical battering what we think of attacks on a child, are we? It's bigger than this?
We're really talking about a lot of different things. We're talking about physical battering of children. We're also talking about verbal barrages, emotional abuse, which it can also be the withholding of affection and love for a child, as well as constantly and chronically belittling them and putting them down. We're including sexual abuse, which can take many different forms, as well as neglect, not providing children with the basic necessities of life.
There was a report in a survey done by your organization a couple of years ago, 1992, I think, that said there seemed to be, in that year, 2.9 million suspected reports of that broad range of child abuse. Mm-hmm. Can you help us get a handle on that number? What's happening out here?
Actually, the number is now even a little bit bigger. We now have the data for 1993. And in 1993, there were over 3 million reports of suspected child abuse and neglect. I think it's important to keep in mind that not all of those upon investigation were proven to be cases of serious child abuse. In fact, the number was over a million. That is still a very substantial number. Over 1 million children confirmed to have been very seriously abused or neglected in the past year, a number which is larger than the previous year and the year prior to that. Another way to think about that number is just to look at child abuse fatalities. Last year, there were at least 3 children each day who died as a result of child maltreatment, either from physical blows or severe neglect.
Characterize our nation relative to that phenomena. Let's ask it this way. I hear from some corners that, like the poor, child abuse has always been with us. Whenever 2 or 3 are gathered together, there's a potential for child abuse, which seems to be the nature argument. Mm-hmm. The nurture argument seems to be that whatever it was in the past, it's worse now. We have families falling apart and changing moral values and alcoholism and drug abuse and stress and two-earner families. And so what do you think? Is it...
It's actually both. There are books written about the 18th century and the 16th century, even prior to that, and it's clear that children, in one form or another, have been consistently abused by adults, sometimes not within their own family. Sometimes they've been sold into slavery. Sometimes they've been sold in other ways to other people for other uses. Sometimes it's been through the use of child labor. But consistently through the history of mankind, children have not been the favored class, the class that has been always treated tenderly and carefully. In our country, it would seem as though, because of things that have happened in the last several decades, the way in which we treat children is in fact worse than it was, let's say, during the 1950s.
Why? So
even though you can talk to people who are now in their 80s or their 90s and they will report tales of how they were abused as children, we know physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional maltreatment, neglect within the home has been in this country for a long time. Most recently, it appears that the numbers are a lot higher. You could probably isolate out 1 or 2 issues as contributing to that more than anything else. And number one at the very top of the list is the issue of substance abuse, and particularly substance abuse among younger people and new parents. It's certainly the case that there is greater use of more volatile drugs today than would have been true 30 or 40 years ago. But if you look at the people who are using those drugs, new parents in particular, and the impact that those drugs have on their behavior or lack of behavior in terms of taking care of their children, you can see why that has contributed mightily. Let me just give you a statistic. Statistics sometimes are hard to think about, but in 1985, 17% of the children who died as a result of child abuse in the state of New York were killed, if you will, directly as a result of alcoholism and drug abuse. In other words, the person who perpetuated the abuse that led to the death of a child were severely hooked on drugs or alcohol, 17%. Today, the number's over 80%. Not only are the number of deaths up, but the number of deaths associated with the use of alcoholism and drugs has increased dramatically. So that's number one problem. We're looking at a different situation today with parents, and particularly new parents, than we were before. But secondly, I don't want to label this as poverty in and of itself, but the numbers of people who live in poverty and the numbers of people who never escape poverty has been increasing. And so you have from one generation to the next, from parents to children to their children, passing along a lifestyle that inherently is not good for children, where parents cannot provide for their children, where the use of violence, where the lack of housing, the lack of opportunity is so great that the care and nurturing of children has just fallen apart. That's a long answer to say it's a problem that's been around for a long time, and it's been growing recently.
And is it growing specifically in areas of poverty and alcohol or substance abuse in general?
Very definitely. Even though this is a problem we will find in every corner of society, it is certainly growing within those communities that are experiencing severe economic distress and for which alcoholism and drug abuse are significant factors. And those communities have been growing in size. The number of children born into poverty today is twice what it was a little over a decade ago. So more and more children are confronted with these problems. The Carnegie Corporation came out with a very interesting report in April. A very troubling report, actually, because they looked at what's going on with the youngest children in our society, children ages 0 to 3. And they project that children being born today are very likely to experience abuse, neglect, lack of good medical care, poor nurturing, such that probably 25% of the children being born today will simply not be ready to learn when they get to school, will have been deprived of the kind of nurturing, the kind of intellectual stimulation, the kind of medical care, the kind of healthy environment that they need. So when they get to school, they're ready to even learn how to read a book. The tragedy of that, when you think about the implications of that in the long term for those children and for all of us, is really substantial.
This is what you mean when you say this is a public health crisis.
Absolutely. It touches every segment of our society. It's very widespread and has long-term implications.
This is Ann Con Donnelly. She is with us from Chicago, where she heads the National Committee for the Prevention of Child Abuse. She has been the executive director of that national organization since 1980. Looking back at your work history and educational history, this has been your focus since you were a very young woman. I mean, since you emerged
very
almost
young.
From high school, yes?
That's a complimentary way of saying I'm younger than I am. It's certainly an area that I've been focusing on for 2 decades now, yeah. Both as a researcher, as a policy analyst, and also as a program administrator.
Mm-hmm. Ann Con Donnelly with us on Conversations. How aware are we as a nation of the extent of this problem? You've said some fairly startling things in the last few minutes.
You know, it's interesting. Our awareness, depending upon how you measure it, is very substantial or not enough. We actually ourselves do an annual public opinion poll to find out what the public knows about the child abuse problem and what they're doing about it. And since 1983, that's a long time ago, in our annual public opinion polls, over 90% of the public has said, I understand that child abuse is a major problem in our country. So in terms, you ask the question, does the public know that this is a major problem? The answer is absolutely yes. I mean, it's hard to find an adult who does not understand that this is a major problem. On the other hand, if you ask people, is this a problem that touches you directly? Is this a problem in your neighborhood? Do you know families where this is a problem? It's unusual to find a person who says yes. In other words, people recognize that there's a problem, but it's someone else's problem. They recognize that children are being injured, but it's not children they know. They know that adults out there are molesting kids, but no adults they've ever encountered. And that's a major barrier to our efforts to do something about this problem. Until we all realize it happens in our neighborhoods, It might, in fact, be happening in our family. It's going to be awfully tough to get people involved in efforts to stop it.
I don't know whether this question comes out of left field or not, but as I've been thinking about this interview, here are some of the headlines that have come up. Pederast Ed Savitz ran a literal network of young boys whom he bribed, paid for sexual favors. Michael Jackson accused of sexual abuse of a young friend. Priests and clergy accused of long-term sexual abuse of children. 19 children found living in squalor in a ghetto. Mother shoots accused molester of her son. And the question, and I mean, I don't know how many would come to mind if I gave it 20 minutes instead of 5 minutes of thinking of it. The question I had when I came to the end of this short list was, do these headline-making, Entertainment Tonight, hard copy, even New York Times headline-making stories, heighten our awareness or distract us from knowing, as you say, that child abuse occurs in our neighborhoods and our families?
I'll tell you what we think they've done in recent years. We think they have numbed people, not so much to the problem, but to the possibility to do anything about it. In other words, people are aware of this problem. There are continually headlines. It's like, oh, yes, it's still a problem. But when it comes across as so grim and so 19 children living in one apartment, how could this happen? There's the sense that, well, there's nothing we can do about it. It's hopeless. It just keeps happening. And I think that we actually have tracked this in our public opinion polls. The public is a lot less optimistic today about our ability to do something about this problem than they were 10 years ago.
So knowing about it has made us think it's simply ubiquitous. It's like the
it's
air
inevitable.
We breathe. It's
yeah.
inevitable.
One of the things that we are going to put a lot of energy into in the next 5 years or so is to try and turn that around. In fact, there are a lot of really powerful, exciting, and useful things that we can do so that children are never abused. And hopefully we'll have a chance to talk about some of those things in some depth. We need to make sure the public knows about those things. So next time they see the headline, 19 children found living together in an apartment severely neglected, they'll think, oh, if only that community had had the program I heard about last week. I'm going to see if I can help that community get that program, because that program would have made a difference. We need to turn people's thinking around to see that there really are some very exciting solutions to this problem. And it's not just one bad case after another.
Let me introduce people to what I know about the National Committee, and then maybe you can expand on that. Because when you say we, I'm sure there's a gap. Ancon Donnelly oversees 64 National Committee for the Prevention of Child Abuse chapters, which exist in 50 states. The NCPCA also creates nationwide public service media campaigns on the subject of child abuse. It's a national center on child abuse prevention research. It has projects like the National Healthy Families America Project, which we'll talk about towards the end of the hour, I think, and also offers training and technical assistance to its network of programs all around the 50 states. One of those programs, a chapter of NCPCA, is our own Resource Center for Parents and Children in Fairbanks here, and has been in Fairbanks to address a national conference for NCPCA members, which has been held in Fairbanks late in the month of June. So it's a brief introduction to your organization. Is that solid for now? We can go on from there?
That was a great introduction. You know, the easiest way to think about what is our organization, it's an organization which has as its mission stopping child abuse before it happens.
How long have you been around?
I've been executive director for 14 years.
Since 1980.
Since
and 1980. The organization has existed?
Founded in 1972.
Oh, a long time. I want to ask you, you said we fail to recognize child abuse in our homes and in our neighborhoods. Some people will be saying, how can that be? How do we fail, especially to recognize the abuse of a child in my home?
If you're the one who's doing it, sometimes it's hard to really take a look at what it is you're doing. This becomes much more clear, I think, if we talk specifically about what one kind of abuse, yes. Verbal abuse. What is verbal abuse? It's the constant and chronic belittling, putting down, criticizing of a child. You're so stupid. You're never going to amount to anything. I hate you. I wish you were never born. There are parents who do that day in and day out, not with malicious intent, even though the outcome for the child is a very negative one, because the child grows up believing they're never going to amount to anything, and they don't. They grow up believing, everyone wishes I was never born. I wish I was never born. Mm-hmm. They don't feel good about themselves. So parents engage in this without even hearing their words, without even stopping to think about the impact of what they're saying is on their children, without taking the moment to realize that their children believe what they're saying. So there are forms of abuse that happen in lots of homes, like verbal abuse, which people aren't even tuned into. Mm-hmm. And so often when they are, so often when parents stop to listen to what they're saying, they can catch themselves. They can stop doing it. That's an example. Another kind of example is the case of sexual abuse. There may be, in many families this happens, there may be someone within the extended family who is a molester, who has perpetrated sexual abuse upon not just one, but a series of children in the family, most often young girls, has threatened those girls so they keep it a secret, and those girls are terrified to tell anybody. And it's not known. Maybe people have some funny feelings about Uncle Jim and the way he interacts with some of the girls, but they just don't stop to think much about it. Maybe one of the girls says something, but they don't stop to really believe it's happening.
I think this is very hard for us to accept, even in 1994. Tell me about a sexual abuser. Is Ed Savitz, the committed pederast, is the man who believes that children should be sexually educated by adults, is the man who can't sort out, cope with an adult relationship? Are they all the same people? The stranger lurking in the schoolyard and Uncle Jim?
They all are committing similar crimes. And in that sense, there's something similar about them all. But you've mentioned a few cases that are really at the extreme, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of shock value, even though all of this is shocking. The father or the uncle, the family member who molests some one or more children within a family, is a person who has some very serious problems. The same would be true of some of the well-known perpetrators you mentioned. We have more hope for the person who's molesting someone within their own family.
Why? And tell me about treatment and hope. It used to be that people thought you just put them away and don't think about them anymore. And for maybe 20 years, there's been an effort to not punish so much, but treat. Mm-hmm. What?
Well, there's probably a need in all of these cases, specifically of sexual abuse, to make sure there is some punishment. I mean, what has happened is absolutely intolerable to anybody in society who hears about it. And there is a need for some kind of serious intervention on the part of law enforcement. But at the same time, there are some people who are molesters who haven't developed such a chronic career of molesting, and for whom the motivations have a lot to do with their own inadequacies, for whom some kind of intervention, some kind of treatment could make a difference, so they could straighten themselves out. And for those people, it's worth taking the time and the energy to offer them the kind of therapeutic assistance they need. Because after all, even as there's a tremendous amount of hatred and spite within a family when this happens, mm-hmm. there are also some connections of love and affection that might be worth trying to preserve if possible.
How optimistic are you?
I think that with a percentage of the cases of, now we're talking specifically about sexual abuse, mm-hmm. We can make a difference. It's not the majority of cases, but it's not 5%. You know, it's more, certainly more than that. And I, you know, for those families, for those people, it's well worth taking the time and the energy. And it's also important to recognize that there are some pedophiles for whom there is no treatment that's going to be helpful. And we need to take more serious actions as a society to make sure that they don't pose threats to children.
And what does that mean to you? Is that
it may mean imprisonment.
Mm-hmm.
It may mean, and some communities have done this, finding other ways to absolutely isolate them from chances of being involved with children. There are a variety of actions that can be taken, legal and coercive or otherwise, but it's important to take them.
It seems to me that families and communities are very conflicted. This is a very emotionally distressing area. If it's someone who preys on children at the schoolyard, it seems we're very willing as a community just to say, throw him out. Mm-hmm. This is someone we can afford to waste. But when it's a teacher in the community, or a coach, or a Boy Scout or Girl Scout advisor, or an uncle or a stepfather, that's very complicated. We're very conflicted as a society.
It is. It challenges all of our values. Mm-hmm. And I think of all the forms of abuse, sexual abuse brings us out an awful lot more. I mean, I think it is easier for people certainly to recognize physical abuse and to draw the line about what's okay and what's not okay, certainly in terms of very serious physical abuse that results in significant physical injury. Sexual abuse brings out all kinds of conflicting feelings in us, you know, and when it's appropriate to intervene and how it's appropriate to intervene, how seriously we need to take this. You know, you think of an analogous issue, and that's the issue of domestic violence. At this moment in the history of our country and in our society, the issue of one spouse beating another brings out the same very conflicted feelings. The outrage that people feel knows no bounds, and at the same time, their sense of, whoa, this is a matter of privacy within mm-hmm. a family. Mm-hmm. And I think the same thing is true with sexual abuse of children. It's very complicated.
There will be someone in our listening audience who has been concerned about sexual abuse or physical abuse in their own family. Do you have any thoughts for that person?
I think it's very important when someone knows that someone else is in jeopardy, particularly someone too young to protect themselves, a child, to do something to help guarantee safety for that person. You would do it if you saw a person drowning in a pond. You would do it if you saw a person in a car accident who couldn't get themselves out of the car. You would do it if you knew someone was in a house that was on fire. It is terribly important for people to take just as seriously some child they might know who is seriously being put into a situation of jeopardy, either at the hands of their own parents or the hands of someone else. There are many different things someone can do, you know, ranging from reporting something to the authorities with the hopes that the authorities will come in and do an investigation and find out what's going on, to actually finding some ways to intervene yourself, which is something I personally think in some situations is very much warranted. But I think it is incumbent upon all of us to take seriously what is happening to the children in our community and to do things to make sure they're safe.
A lot of people will say these days that even kids are affected by Hollywood and headlines and will speak falsely about issues of sexual abuse or physical abuse mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. emotional abuse. Mm-hmm. What's your thought about that?
Well, there are a couple things that we know, and our knowledge is certainly evolving. We do know that there are false reports of child abuse, particularly false reports of child sexual abuse. We know that most often those false allegations are made by adults. It's not children making up stories. For example, in a custody dispute, one parent will accuse the other of molesting the child in order to gain custody of the children. So we need to be aware of the fact that there are such things as false reports, sometimes well-intentioned. You know, sometimes someone really believes a child is seriously in jeopardy and will report this incident so that the child will get some help. They're very well-intentioned. Sometimes there are malicious intentions with those false reports. And all of us need to be vigilant, particularly professionals in the field who get involved in investigating reports, to try and tease out those that are false reports, particularly with malicious intent. There are instances in which children have indeed made up allegations of child abuse, and these can be very damaging to the people involved. And it's incumbent upon professionals to be very thoughtful in the way in which they do investigations. And that's what professionals are hired to do, and that's what they're trained to do. And increasingly, they do a better job of that. They know how to ask the right questions to get at information to find out whether or not this is a made-up story or, in fact, a real story. There is that question about what members of the general public should do if a child comes to them and says, I've been abused. My own personal belief is that adults should err on the side of believing the child and at least making sure that professionals with the right credentials can come in and do an investigation, rather than assuming the child's made it up. Mm-hmm. far better to at least let someone who knows how to handle this do a job of handling it.
This is Anne Condonley with us today on Conversations. Her educational background, I indicated earlier, has been focused on this area of study and research since early on. She took her bachelor's from the University of Michigan, her master's in medical sociology from Tufts, a second master's in public health administration and planning from the University of California at Berkeley, and then also from the University of California School of Public Health, a doctorate in public health with a major focus in administration and planning. Anne Condonley, the executive director of the National Committee to Prevent Child Abuse since 1980. There are people who say Big Brother is too much with us. The state runs roughshod over parents who are accused falsely or rightly. Children are ripped out of homes. Parents are stuffed into programs or worse, stuffed into jail. In the same spirit of asking how you listen to a child, how do you approach this concern that the state's just too aggressive, whatever that means, the state of Alaska or Alabama or the federal government? Or,
you know, we're in a very perplexing time in our country right now. It used to be 20 years ago that when you reported a case of child abuse to the authorities, while there was an investigation, the whole focus of what one did with the report was to try and find out if there were some needs the family had that the state could be responsive to in a really positive way. In fact, it was the case 20 and 30 years ago that if a parent was having difficulty with their own parenting, was afraid they were lashing out and abusing their own children, they often would feel comfortable calling up the state agency and saying, hey, I need a little bit of help. Things have changed dramatically in the last 20 or 30 years. Today, the primary role of the state agency, regrettably, has become to investigate reports and find out whether or not a law has been broken. Mm-hmm. And very few resources are left over to actually provide any kind of support to families if they need it. So you have a situation where the primary focus, once reports have been made, is on investigation, on trying to prove guilt or innocence. And as we prove guilt, to try and say, well, we got to make sure the children are safe. And a logical response on the part of a state agency to make sure children are safe, since they have no resources to provide treatment services to the families, is to take the child away. And so there are these concerns that maybe too often children are being placed in foster care, and maybe too often too much focus is being placed on legal issues and not enough on family needs. Mm-hmm. Even as those concerns are being raised, however, there are many people who are saying, hey, wait a minute. There are too many times when there have been reports of child abuse and the state has done an investigation and found it's not particularly serious, and they've left the child in the home, and a week later or 2 months later or a year later, the child returns in the hospital with serious physical injuries, and in some cases, even dead on arrival. We aren't doing enough to remove children from the home, some people will say. So we have this terrible situation today where we have a system that once was in a position to be able to support families that increasingly now is required to focus more and more on investigation. We have a situation where sometimes errors are made in removing children when they should have been left at home. And in equal number of cases, children are not being removed when perhaps they should have. And where does the answer lie? The answer lies in trying to improve these systems so that the burden is not so much on them to just do investigations, but that they really can help families, to make sure workers are getting far better training so that they can make better decisions about when to leave children in the home and when to remove them. But also to make sure that the public is better educated about when to report cases and about what expectations they can have from these agencies in the first place.
I hear also unsaid in what you're saying that there's a role for organizations like the Resource Center for Parents and Children and like the national organization to fill in those nurturing, training, teaching, support gaps.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I guess the thing that I'm most passionate about is the whole notion of what we could do so that there don't need to be reports in the first place. Unlike 20 years ago, we actually know a tremendous amount today about how to prevent child abuse in the first place. There are things that we can do that the Resource Center here in Fairbanks is doing and that programs across the country are now starting to do to support parents from the time their babies are born, when they have ornery toddlers and cranky infants and just say no two-year-olds. They're ways to support parents so that those very normal, natural situations with children don't translate into the potential for abuse, but rather opportunities to enhance parent and child relationships.
Let's move to those topics in just a few moments. I want to ask you a couple more questions about child abuse. Here's another headline case and two philosophical streams. The headline case is caning in Singapore, around which we heard lots of editorial comment, talk show comment, newspaper write-ups, television programs on why this was a good idea. Youth are running rampant, even in Singapore and here, and we've got to get the strap back up. Mm-hmm. Now, the two streams are, you spare the rod and you spoil the child, that corporal punishment is an appropriate way to raise a child. The use of corporal punishment is appropriate in raising a child. The other side is that children need to be gentled into life, need to have need to have issues presented before them in discussion rather than in punishment. Tell me where you think our nation is going, given these two streams and whatever else follows along and headlines like caning in Singapore.
You know, it's interesting. I mentioned earlier that we do annual public opinion polls to see what the public is thinking about these issues. And we've actually noticed quite a remarkable trend. Over the last 10 years, maybe 15 years, larger and larger numbers of parents in particular, but members of the general public also, are opposed to the use of corporal punishment. Increasingly, members of the general public and parents think that the use of corporal punishment can seriously jeopardize not only the physical well-being of a child, but also their emotional development. So today, the majority of members of the general public, I think it's 60%, and even larger percent of parents are opposed to the use of physical punishment by parents in order to discipline their children. I have a hunch that those numbers will not be identical if you were to ask people about the issue of using corporal punishment or physical punishment or even caning with respect to children, particularly teenagers, who have broken the law. I have a hunch that the public in our country has a sense of what are some more positive ways to raise children today, and the pendulum has swung in the direction of less use of physical force. But I don't think that means that the general public thinks that we should necessarily not use physical punishment with teenagers who have violated serious laws. I think those are regarded as two separate issues. And it's something we're going to be looking at in our research in the coming years. It sounds contradictory. I don't think it is.
Well, I want to explore the question of contradiction. Do you think this is a point on the evolutionary track socially, that if we're moving along, changing the way we view ourselves, changing the way we view our children, given this specific discussion, are we having two diverse paths on this evolutionary track, or is this something else again?
Well, I think it's a question of what people are thinking about as being appropriate in their own child-rearing practices versus what punishment society ought to mete out for people who have violated laws.
Oh, and those are those other people, aren't they?
Yes.
Yes, of course. Those aren't my kids.
Right.
I wonder how it would feel if you caned my kid. Well, we see the father of that young boy. I see. Ancon Donnelly is with us today on Conversations. One more question about child abuse in general. I believe you will tell me that the effects of child abuse physically and psychologically, by which I mean the whole range of child abuse, are devastating. There's also an understanding, and I don't know whether it's cultural or global, that children are very resilient, that if you bruise me, I heal. If you insult me, I sort myself out. Connected with this latter one is thinking that children don't just have one influence in their lives. There are there's a list: church, school, beloved mm-hmm. teachers, preachers, mm-hmm. Girl Scout, Boy Scout leader, the neighbor down the street who's the surrogate mother when the mother isn't mothering. Given those, again, that range of thoughts, tell me about the effects of child abuse on children in this culture at this time. Mm-hmm. What's your take on this?
The thing that we know is that children who are seriously abused and neglected suffer a wide variety of different emotional and developmental difficulties. Their language development may be delayed. Their socialization skills may be non-existent. Their sense of themselves may be crushed. A variety of different emotional and developmental difficulties. We know that children who are abused are 6 times more likely than children who are not abused to grow up and repeat the pattern, become abusers. Huh. But we also know that most abused children do not grow up and abuse their own children. So even though you're at greater risk to become an abuser if you were treated that way when you were young, it's not a foregone conclusion that that's what you're going to do. And what is going on is children are not growing up in a very narrow context. They're growing up in the broader context of society. And even though they may have suffered a variety of emotional and developmental scars as a result of the way, let's say, their parents treated them, along the way there may be a teacher or an uncle or a best friend or a book they read or mm-hmm. a series of other experiences that will give them what it is they need to be good parents themselves. So you're absolutely right. Children live in a very complex set of environments as they grow up, and all of the different things they experience have some influence. The single most important influence in a person's life has to do with their relationship, certainly with their mother, and most often with both their parents, whether or not those parents are both in their home, whether or not they ever meet both of those parents. But the connection that we all have to the people who are our parents are the center part of how it is we develop. And so when that relationship is put in jeopardy through abuse, it creates difficulties which can be ameliorated along the way by other influences but aren't as easily ameliorated.
Let's talk about prevention. This is your driving subject. You said a minute ago, we know how to raise healthy families. We know how to teach people to raise healthy families. Mm. Introduce us to some of those ways. What do you know?
Let's just take for a moment the issue of young children who are abused, children under the age of 5. Irrespective of how they are abused, they make up the majority of reports of child abuse, the majority of child abuse fatalities. In fact, more than half of all children who die as a result of child abuse are under the age of 1. So let's just take for a moment children under the age of 5 who are abused. What do we know about their families? Their parents, who are very often single parents, tend to be people who were themselves abused as children, who are extremely isolated. Even if there are other adults living under the same roof, they're not people they relate to and can lean on. Mm. They tend to be people who have serious difficulties that I would put under the heading of emotional difficulties. They don't feel good about themselves. They don't feel capable of reaching out and getting any help for themselves. They have low self-esteem. They tend to be people who have difficulties with alcoholism and drug abuse. They probably are in pretty violent relationships with other people, like a spouse or a boyfriend or a girlfriend. And in general, they're people who don't have much in the way of what you would call good parenting skills. Knowing that that is typically what you would find in parents who abuse very young children, if you wanted to think about, boy, how could we prevent this problem? If we could get to those parents at the time their babies are born and identify those who are isolated, who had pretty troubling childhoods, who are having difficulties with domestic violence or spouse abuse or any one of a number of these other issues I've mentioned, if we could identify them at the time their babies are born and help them out, help them get some treatment for their drug problem, teach them some parenting skills, mm-hmm. help them develop a network of other people who they could lean on for help with their own baby and with their own problems, it seems logical that we could go a long way in reducing the likelihood that they will abuse their children. Now, the fact is, we have 2 decades of research that proves that's the case. It's not just logical. It's scientific fact. If we can identify people at the time their babies are born, before they've developed negative or dysfunctional patterns of parenting, and can support them enough and teach them enough, mm-hmm. we can help them get off to a good start. And their children are going to be just fine.
I read an article you wrote for Children Today, I think it was in 1992, that talked about a pilot program in Hawaii that's been very successful. I was impressed. Can you tell us how that's worked?
The state of Hawaii has been doing something for almost a decade now, where in hospitals they reach out and flag those parents who they would call the most overburdened. The parents who at the time of the birth of their baby say, oh, I am terrified about what it's going to be like when I get home with this new baby. I wish someone would offer a helping hand. Mm. And what they do in Hawaii is once they identify those people is they offer them on a strictly voluntary basis. This is not a coercive governmental program. It is strictly voluntary. They offer them the services of a home visitor who is willing to come and visit them in their home once a week more often and hook them up with different services in the community. It may be something like the Resource Center for Parents and Children here in Fairbanks or other kinds of services, maybe substance abuse counseling. That home visitor kind of becomes their friend, starts to teach them how to take care of their baby, what to do with the baby's colicky, how to start playing with their baby and enjoy their baby. And what Hawaii has found is when they offer this kind of intensive services beginning in the home from the time of birth, and work with those families, sometimes for a number of years, it varies, that they can reduce the amount of child abuse dramatically. You know, in Hawaii, with the first 3,000 families they've worked with, families where you would have expected the abuse rates to be 15 to 20%, they were less than 1%. That is a dramatic reduction in the number of children who have had to experience harm. And what's beautiful about the program is that it doesn't cost a lot of money. It is a relatively inexpensive program to do and something one can do universally. So it's not a question of stigmatizing certain parents and saying, boy, it looks like you're going to have a bad time. We're going to make sure you get this effort. It's something you can do universally for everybody and help all new parents get off to a good start.
This is similar to the way you characterized health and social services 20 years ago.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it used to be, and in some communities it is the case, that public health nurses do go out and visit new parents in their home after babies are born. And they could tell if someone was having some problems and offer them a little bit of extra help. It's really going back to that sense of support for new parents. You know, that the Secretary of Education, Secretary Riley, said something recently that has just stuck in my mind. He said, we spend so much energy in our country trying to improve education for our children so that they can be productive members of society. And we come up with curriculum reform for high schools and better ways of training teachers for kindergarten and first grade and fifth grade. All of this effort on education misses a critical fact. And that is the most important time in a child's educational development is the first 2 to 3 years of their life. That's when their brains are 90% of what their brains are going to become are formed. When all the different connections between all the different cells in their brain, think of it almost as a computer, kind of gets set when the software is put into place. And he said, if we really care about the education of our children in this country, we need to go back to the day they're born and make sure their parents really know how to be their children's first and best teachers. That's the best way for us to make sure when they get to school they're ready to learn and later on they become productive members of society. Huh. And that's what this notion of preventing child abuse includes, is getting to children at the earliest possible moment at the time they're born and helping their parents so they really can all get off to a good start.
At the time of the article you wrote in Children Today, you indicated that the Hawaii Project could go national. Has it? Will it?
There are some really astonishingly exciting things happening. Today there are approximately 70 communities across the country which already have programs like this in place. Every single state, Alaska included, have task forces working at the state level to figure out how to make this a universal program. People in Washington are talking about what they can do about it. It is an effort that is moving ahead with great excitement and much more rapidly than we ever could have hoped.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about mothering and fathering. Mothering is thought of as a verb. Fathering is an unusual word we're unfamiliar with. How important is it to have intact families with two actively participating parents? This is another question mm-hmm. of divergent streams. Mm-hmm. There are people saying that mm-hmm. single parenting is the wave of the future, and there are people saying that this is ripping the moral fabric of America apart.
You know, the way I like to think about it is from the child's perspective. What children need, particularly in the earliest years, is constant love, nurturing, affection, intellectual stimulation, predictability, a sense that they matter, and someone who's going to start guiding them through the world to show them how to make sure they matter. When there are two people in a home providing that nurturing and love and affection, it works best. Mm-hmm. When there are two people in a home and one of them is ignoring that responsibility, there are problems. When there's only one adult in a home and they're ignoring that responsibility, there are problems. Optimally, children would have both their mother and their father, or a mother figure and a father figure, whether they be adopted or whatever, present in their lives in a very active and nurturing way from day one. That's what helps children develop to their maximum potential. Now, can children develop to their maximum potential without that? Sure. It's harder. It's harder on the parent. It's harder on the child. It's not impossible. So there's certainly room in our society for a variety of ways in which children can be brought into this world and can be nurtured. But what's critical is that there be adults there who are nurturing and are consistently nurturing and help those children know how valued they are.
What's your sense over the long haul as to where we're going in that respect? You've talked about survey results that say we are wanting to treat, if not treating, our children more gently in raising them. There's interest in men fathering as much as women mothering. Where are we going?
Well, there's my hope, and then there's maybe what is the reality. Mm-hmm. My hope is that we will, as a society, realize that fathers have critical roles to play in children's lives and need to be there. The reality is today about 25% of all children born this year, and probably next year and the year after, are going to be born without much knowledge, if any knowledge, about who their fathers are. I think that's kind of tragic for many of those children, because I think they would benefit from knowing who their fathers are and having their fathers be very present in their lives. And yet that's been a trend that's been building and growing for well over a decade.
I think that's an environmental question as well as an internal question about families. And it makes me think about another environmental question. Both parents can be at home, or one parent can be at home, and there can be someone who comes in from the Healthy Child Program, Healthy Families Program, to help. And there can still be poverty, lack of education, not decent jobs, dreadful mm-hmm. housing. Mm-hmm. What's the NCPCA's thought on helping the whole environment of a child's life when, as you say, those problems are increasing, not decreasing?
You know, if our organization had the capacity, and I don't think we do, to squarely address the issue of poverty in this country, that's where we ought to put our energy. It's not fair for children to grow up in poverty. Certainly not all poor children are abused and neglected, but it's not fair for them to start out in life without having access to all the wonderful gifts our society can offer. And I'm not talking about material possessions, but I'm talking about a sense of stability, a sense of predictability, being free from violence in your environment. You know, in a city like Chicago, the communities where people are gunned down every single day are the communities where people are living in poverty. It's not fair for children to grow up in those situations. I was at a meeting just last week, and it was a room filled with 8 and 9-year-olds. And someone asked them, how many of you, you've heard these stories. It's when you see it that just chills you. How many of you in the last year have seen someone use a gun? And almost every hand in the room went up. How many of you believe in the next year you're going to be forced to join a gang? And every little boy in the room raised his hand. I mean, that's just not fair for children to be growing up in those environments. So if our organization had the capacity to address that issue squarely, boy, that's where I'd put my money. But we don't. We're a small organization relative to our nation and relative to all the powers that be. It's certainly an issue we speak out about. I think we can make a big difference in the amount of child abuse. I'm not sure we can make a big difference in the amount of poverty, our organization.
Well, and I think that's an issue where the rest of us also feel helpless. You talked very early in this program about a sense that child abuse is so ever-present in our society that it's just too overwhelming. I think poverty is like that. I don't know how to ask you what's the average Joe to do, but except to say, is there any way that we can be responsive?
You know, there actually are 100 ways. We all tend to vote. Who we vote for has a lot to do with the kind of policies and laws we have. So if you're a person deeply concerned about a particular issue, check out what the candidates believe. That's one small thing. Mm-hmm. All of us live in communities that have newspapers, that have radio call-in shows. Some have television talk shows. There are ample opportunities in any community to find forums to speak out about what you feel, whether it be with a Rotary Club or the Elks or with an op-ed piece in your local newspaper. Take some energy. Take stepping up to the plate and saying, I'm going to speak out about this. But it's something that in our country, all of us have the right and the freedom to do. Mm-hmm. And I encourage people to do that. All of us have in our communities agencies that are working to try and help families. Here you have the Resource Center on Parents and Children and a number of other really wonderful programs going on. All of these programs benefit from volunteers who come and help with the daycare or help with the transportation or help with the fundraising or help with stuffing envelopes. Any of us can volunteer to do those kinds of things. And all of us know people who are struggling as parents. We really all do. And to reach out and offer a helping hand, whether it's just taking care of the kids for a while or sitting down just to listen, have a cup of coffee and say, boy, you know, things seem pretty stressed out for you. Want to talk about it? All of us can do that. And offer a bit of a helping hand to someone we know. So the average person, whoever we are, because we are all those people, all have things that we can do.
You said you had hopes and concerns regarding fathers and families. As you look out over the next 5 years or so, what's possible for an organization like yours, or for a nation like ours? I guess you can answer that however you feel. And what's too overwhelming? Where's your optimism and concern?
You know, there are some things that we do unwittingly, unknowingly, that we can change. I've talked about this program in Hawaii that we're working to take nationwide. And the first step in that program is to meet with new parents and find out what kind of challenges they're going to face and whether or not they could benefit from this kind of a service. Almost always those conversations are held with the mother, and only the mother. It's unwittingly that one is essentially saying fathers don't count. Mm-hmm. That's something an organization like ours or programs like ours could change. We could just make it a rule. We meet with mothers and fathers together. It's a small step, but there's an important message there. Same when home visitors make their appointments to go out and visit people in their home with their new babies. Find a time when mothers and fathers are both around. If the father's not in the household, find a way to involve that person in this program. So those are some things that professionals can do. I think there are a lot of other things that we can all do just in terms of recognizing the opportunities that fathers have. It is rare to find a father who doesn't find joy in being a father. How about talking about that more publicly? How about making that more a part of our public consciousness so that fathers will want to take credit for a baby that's born and say, yes, this baby is mine, and I want to be in this baby's life because I'm going to benefit from it because being a father is a really neat thing to be. Mm-hmm. Those are just a few ideas.
Culturally, there's a concern that we're leaving our children behind, that this has become an adult's world. America has become an adult's world. Given we've probably got 4 or 5 minutes left, what do you think about that? Are we, if we've left fathers behind, which is what I hear you saying, is this culture leaving children behind, or are we reaching to get them wherever we've left them and bring them back?
I think in many ways we've left children behind. I guess I have some hope that some of that's going to change over the next 5 years or so. I think there's a growing consciousness that we've done that. and a growing concern about what the implications of that are. You know, you look at, just look at some of the federal programs. Let's put defense aside. People always say, oh, if we could only take one of those B-42 bomb, whatever they're called, bombers, and take that money, well, we could solve the nation's problem. Forget about those monies. Just look at some of the other federal programs we have in place. Relatively few of them are targeted in such a way that they actually benefit children. Welfare. Women don't qualify for welfare unless the fathers are not in the home. I mean, we have a public policy, a law, a regulation that dictates that children are going to suffer because they're not going to be able to have easy access to their dads. Their dads have to be out of the home in order for their mothers to qualify for welfare. That is an example, but you will find both our laws and our public policy replete with examples like that where we haven't really considered what is in the best interest of the child. And we need to, because children do get left behind, and we're all going to suffer later because they are the ones that are going to be running our country later on. And if they haven't gotten what they need, they're not going to be able to give the nation what it needs.
Mm-hmm. What's your organization going to do in the next 4 or 5 years? What's your focus?
I hope that we're going to be able to make sure that all new parents have a chance to get off to a good start, mothers and fathers, that those that are most overburdened get the help they need. I hope we're going to be able to make sure that fewer and fewer children under the age of 5 are devastated by abuse, that more and more of those children are able to get good health, they're immunized, and when they get to school, they're ready to learn.
Mm-hmm. So you're following Hawaii and Secretary Riley's lead in that case.
It seems like a crucial first step. It's certainly not the only thing we need to do, but it's an important place to start.
Ann Conn Donnelly with us, the Executive Director of the National Committee to Prevent Child Abuse. Ann Conn Donnelly has been our guest today on Conversations. Among her awards and honors early on, she was a Congressional Science Fellow and worked in the office of the Honorable Al Gore when he was in Congress. Yeah. Right after that, a White House fellowship took her to the office of the Secretary of Health and Human Services, where she advised, among other things, on issues related to child abuse. In 1989, the Vincent DeFrancis Award was hers, granted by the American Humane Association, and in 1990, the Brant F. Steele Award, given by the C. Henry Kemp National Center. C. Henry Kemp is one of the foundation researchers in the area of child abuse. Ann Conn Donnelly, thank you very much for a very interesting hour.
Thank you.
Just a small note. There are over 120,000 volunteers who work indirectly for the National Committee to Prevent Child Abuse by volunteering at organizations that are part of this coalition, that are chapter organizations throughout the nation. If you want to get involved in your local center, the Resource Center for Parents and Children might be a place to start. I'm Susan McGinnis. This has been Conversations for KUAC. I hope you'll join me again next week.